Relax your spleen. Relax your liver. Relax your kidneys. Relax your pancreas. Relax your intestines. Relax your colon. Relax your bladder. Relax your ovaries or gonads, sexual organs. Relax down through the interior, the inside of your legs. Again, allow your spine to find its balance by gently rolling upward, making sure that the vertebrae are in alignment. Lifting your head, relax your shoulders. And gently bring one shoulder back, allowing the spine to turn. Allow your head to move in the direction of your shoulder. Allow the hips to also move gently, one flowing back, the other gently forward. And then slowly reverse your position, bringing your head gently towards the other side, turning your head back. Allow your shoulders to follow your head, allowing the spine to turn. Gently shift the hips so that one is back, the other forward. So continue for a few more of these shifting movements so that when your left shoulder goes back, your left hip goes back, your head turns to the left, and just allow the spine to shift gently. And as you gently move to the other side, as your head turns to the right and goes back, allow your shoulder, right hip to follow the movement of your head. And gently shift your whole body, gently rotating the spine so that one side of your body moves together and the opposite side of your body moves together in opposing directions back and forth. And gently do one or two more.
And you are listening
back to the center.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
And with your exhaled breath, just send a wave of relaxation through the whole body from the top of your head to the soles of your feet. Inhale deeply. Exhale slowly. Again, inhale deeply. Exhale slowly. One more. Inhale deeply. Exhale slowly.
And now we're going to have a very abrupt change in mood. You're listening to WBAI New York, and coming up now is Hour of the Wolf. I'm Ken Gale, substituting for Jim Freund.
I wanna be like them.
And those were the Tearjerkers, a band out of Belfast. I don't know if they're performing anymore, but I was using that song as the theme to Nuff Said for all. I was doing that show from 93 until 2007, and then occasionally since then. Today, I am presenting an interview with Mark Hamill. Yes, that Mark Hamill. Of course, he's best known as being Luke Skywalker in the Star Wars movies, but that's not the Mark Hamill that I interviewed. Because besides being an actor in Star Wars, he's also a voice actor, and he is very well known as a voice actor for probably being the best actor to perform the Joker, which he did on a Batman animated show. But he's also a major comic book fan, and I ran into him at a comic book store back in, I would have to say it was probably late 80s. And Mark and I, and I'm Ken Gale, by the way, Mark and I shopped at the same comic book store on the west side of Manhattan back when he was living in that area. And one day he comes in, and I knew that we had very similar tastes in comics. And when he came in, I recognized him and started talking to him about Silver Age DC comics, because he's very much into those. He started reading comics before Marvel Comics even existed. That didn't happen until 62. And though he read them when they came out, he continued to be a bigger fan of what he started with, which were the DC comics of the late 50s. At any rate, my wife was with me. Now, we had gone into the store, my wife and I, with her little sister, who did not want to go into the store, but, you know, we wanted to pick up our week's comics. And my wife was also buying some classic underground comics. And it turned out that Mark Hamill's into classic undergrounds as well. So the two of them are chatting about classic undergrounds. However, my wife did not recognize Mark Hamill. He looked familiar to her, and she couldn't figure out where he knew her. And he could tell that she was trying to figure out who he was and didn't recognize him. And he also realized that I did recognize him but was being discreet. Meanwhile, her little sister had her back to us the whole time. She wanted to go in there and get out as soon as she can. And here we were talking to some guy about comic books. Are we ever going to get out of there? But my wife had to take her little sister to a lot of bad movies. She was 10 years younger, and she was just at the right age to have her little teeny bopper crush on Mark Hamill. And I made her big sister take her to a lot of bad movies because Mark Hamill was in them. But she didn't realize that she was in his presence at that very moment. And so we have this great conversation. Went on for a good amount of time. And he's talking about some of his memories of the classic undergrounds, his memories of Silver Age DC comics. Silver Age DC's started in '56. When the Silver Age ended is up for dispute. And I don't want to go into that right now. And so we get home, and I said, that's a really nice conversation we had with Mark Hamill. And she's like, that's who that was. And her little sister's like, oh, no. Well, you should have told me. I said, how am I supposed to tell you? In the middle of a crowded comic book store on a Saturday, I'm supposed to yell out, hey, you know you're talking to Mark Hamill, right? Oh, no. Well, you should have been able to figure out something. I'm like, what? And to this day, we haven't figured out how I could have let her know in a discreet way that she was talking to Mark Hamill. Meanwhile, her little sister's, oh, no. So years go by, and now my wife and I are publishing Evolution Comics. We're guests at a lot of conventions. And there's Mark Hamill, was a guest at one of the same conventions we had. He was plugging a video game that he was doing the voices for. And he was doing a signing at 10 o'clock when the convention opened. I'm like, hey, we get to go in early, so I'll talk to him before the crowd gets here. So I go over to the booth of that gaming company and say, you know, I went to the same comic shop. I do a radio show. I wanted to talk to him about coming onto the radio. And the guy, well, he's busy. I said, no, he's not. He's right over there. And I pointed. He goes over there, and I hear Mark go, where is he? And he comes over, and I'm like, I don't know if you remember me from West Side Comics. And he goes, you're with a woman, right? And he remembered my wife a whole lot better than he remembered me. And then he agreed to come on to Enough Said. The show was on at 4 in the morning on November 8th, 1995. So what you're about to hear is over 22 years old. And it took place at 4 in the morning. And back then, WBAI had a monthly magazine that we gave to our listener supporters called The Folio. And they asked all the producers to give a write-up of you know, who their guests were for, the following month. So I gave the editor, Dave Burstein, here, this is who's coming on November 8th. And he looks at it, and Mark Hamill goes, I should know this name, right? I went, yeah. He goes, he's an actor, right? I went, yeah. What's he doing on at 4 in the morning? And I said, because that's when my show is on. And he goes, well, that's wrong. But at any rate, this is what you're going to hear is that interview. We talked a lot about comics. So I kind of wanted to recreate as much as I could of that conversation at West Side Comics. But also, Mark Hamill he was the voice of the Joker, and he has been reading some of the president's tweets using that voice, and it's absolutely wonderful. You have to. I brought four of them. He's done like six. I brought four of them, and I'll let you hear two now, and then I'll let you hear two more at the end of the show, and I will follow the two tweets with. I broke up the interview, which is well over an hour long, into three parts. So here is Mark Hamill as the Joker reading tweets from the president.
Happy New Year to all, including to my many enemies and those who have fought me and lost so badly. They just don't know what to do. Love. I heard poorly rated morning show speaks badly of me. Don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ crazy Mika along with Psycho Joe came to Mar-a-Lago three nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from the facelift. I said no!
Isn't that amazing? Mark Hamill as the Joker reading some of the tweets that our wonderful president has given us. Again, now here is that interview from, again, November 8th, 1995, at 4 in the morning.
So do you live full-fledged vampire hours 365 days a year?
Nah, just 26 days a year.
Oh, really? So yeah. it's twice a month?
Yeah, we're on every other week.
Well, interesting.
And we alternate with a punk rock show.
Well, is that music that I was hearing while I was on hold? Is that what's going out now?
No, what's going out now?
Well, I'm what's going out now, but just before I went on,
that was the Clash.
That was who?
The Clash.
Oh, the Clash.
Clash City Rockers, yeah.
Oh yeah. Listen, I've got a rock and roller in my family.
You do?
Yes, I do.
Is he performing now?
Well, his band, Backchat, performed at the Whiskey A Go-Go and at the Roxy in the last month. And it was something that I thought was just like a I don't want to say a hobby, but, you know, just a thing for fun. He's in it with John Ritter's son, Jason Ritter.
Right.
And his girlfriend, Brooke, is the lead singer. And another friend is the drummer. And they, out of nowhere, have really sort of surprised me by going out and playing these club dates. Anyway.
Well,
it's,
that's cool. So,
I mean, I
so
feel
creativity
like
it, runs in the family. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know, but I raised him on the right music, you know. I mean, as a toddler, he heard all of the best of the 60s and 70s and more my groups. But, you know, it does give one pause. He's 16 years old.
And, now, music is the reason you sort of quit reading comics back in the 60s, isn't it?
It is true. I mean, my recreational money, so to speak, was limited. And I'm telling you, the Beatles really changed everything, and it just coincided perfectly. I'm 44, so it totally coincided with that shift that every kid goes through when the hormones kick in. Hmm. And suddenly, I mean, I still liked comic books. I didn't have the money for both records and comics, and I know that there was a desire on my parents to sort of, like, shame me out of comic books. There comes a time when, you know, at least in my generation, the grown-ups thought you should give them up as if you know, they represented some sort of emotional a kind of
immaturity.
There you go. Thank you so much for finishing my sentence. But I mean, they were frowned on in my household for sure. Comic books were definitely frowned on. My father, you know, just felt that they, you know, were bad for kids, that they were, you know, representative of a kid who couldn't read real books. And, I mean, it was great in a way because that kept a balance. I mean, I think in a certain sense that that's not all you should read, you know. Even if you're reading novels, I mean, it seems to me that it's much healthier to read a variety of material rather than reading all fantasy all the time. But who knows, as the world gets to be a harsher and more vulgar place to live, I mean, escapism will become all the more important.
Well, certainly, you know, the comic book industry started in the Depression. That's probably not a coincidence.
Yeah, I agree. But, it's, you know, I'm fascinated with the history of comics and the comic strip, too. I mean, going back to you know, tracing it back to its roots, you know, a social satire, political cartoons, you know, even the Penny Dreadfuls in England.
Sure.
There's such precedent for that kind of...
And every one of them got censored by some adult do-gooder group.
I'm sure. You know, all of these things are so cyclical. You know, you hear all of the... I remember when they were going on about Beavis and Butthead and how awful an influence they were, and it sounded like all the same arguments I'd heard before about the Three Stooges.
Yeah, and about comic books and about video games and about pinball machines and about dime novels and series books. And
I wonder why that is. I mean, I guess it's a constant looking to scapegoat or to try and understand why things aren't the way they ought to be in someone's opinion. Rock and roll music to a certain extent.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, same thing.
Devil's,
you know,
music, it was called for so long.
Devil's music, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And comic books are getting it again right now. There's all kinds of groups going out there attacking comic books.
Really? I thought, you know, the shift was more on violent movies now with Money Train and all that.
Well, there's certainly a lot more people against violent movies than there are against comics, but there are a couple groups have sprung up. This one woman out in the Midwest who's trying to get Spawn banned because of the anti-KKK story that it had several months ago.
Because it was an anti-KKK story?
Well, she felt that what she did is on national television, she read bits and pieces of dialogue from the villains.
Uh-huh.
And the villains are saying all these racist things, and they're saying, you can't have children reading these comic books.
Oh, yeah.
And how wonderfully out of context she was being.
Oh, yeah. You find out so often. It's like Bob Dole will attack Money Train, but of course he hasn't seen it.
Yeah, right.
It's a tough call. I mean, I think it's scary that people would want to emulate these kind of, I just read an article either in Time or Newsweek today. They did sort of a tote board of acts that had been somehow reflected in real life, whether it was Taxi Driver inspiring John Hinckley, or a few years ago, there was a film where they actually cut the scene of kids lying down in the middle of the freeway or the highway
right.
to prove their
I forgot the name of the movie, but there was a scene where this kid was reading a Sports Illustrated story about himself at midnight in the middle of the road, and so kids would do that and get run over.
Yeah, not a real wise thing to do.
Yeah, so like, they're out of the gene pool.
The flip side of that, of course, is then you get people coming in and regulating what we see and what we hear, and that's scary, too. You know, I don't know what the balance is here. I really don't. You know, I'm...
Well, you've been in a number of horror movies. Haven't you gotten some flack for the violence in those?
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of funny to me that the kids were more appalled that I showed my rear end in in body bags than they were that I got a pair of gardening shears in the eye. That was kind of cool, they thought. The bare butt, they thought, was really gross. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, it was funny making that with Twiggy, because we're both sort of wimpy when it comes to that kind of, and especially the whole injury to eye motif, which is, you know, has that, the comic book price guide has that category.
Yeah, well, Frederick Wortham was in Seduction of the Innocent went on and on about seduction, about injury to the eye motif.
Yes, well, see, he coined so many of the subcategory, headlights comics.
Right, right.
Bondage, spanking. The book itself, Seduction of the Innocents, one of my favorite little pieces of esoterica that I have in my collection now. I don't really actively collect comics as much now as I did, say, 10, 15 years ago, but one of my favorite pieces that I acquired was, I was always looking for the Seduction of the Innocent with the bibliography intact.
Wow, yeah.
Without it being razored out.
Sure.
And a comic book dealer, I believe he still has a... Yeah, he runs Metropolis Comics in New York. Steven Fischler found me a copy in Texas, which not only had the, get this is really exciting, had the bibliography intact, had the dust jacket, and had a signature from Dr. Wortham inside
Goodness.
It, and it said, to so-and-so, a regular Wonder Woman when it comes to stenography. Regards for Frederick Wortham, and to me, that book is so evocative of those times. I mean, that's actually before my time, because I didn't catch up to ECs until, gosh, those paperbacks that came out like in the 60s, the Autumn People and Tales from the Crypt, I think, had paperback, black and white paperback editions put out.
Oh, that was like, yeah, early 70s, like 70.
Was that early 70s?
Yes.
Well, somehow I think I must have seen, maybe they were back issues. I mean, I was astonished. I mean, how there was a story in it that I'll never forget about a guy that goes to another planet, discovers like this beautiful woman on this other planet, and brings her back and marries her, and I might be getting the elements of it wrong. I mean, I can't even remember the title of it, but if you don't mind me giving away the shocker ending, they have this sort of idyllic romance, get married, and there's a terrible car accident, and the Let's see. You know, I think I got the genders wrong, because I think it's a female astronaut that marries a guy on the planet, brings the guy back. That's what it is. And she sees this horrendous mutant creature with tentacles lying next to the car, and she screams in horror and realizes, as he tells her, that he was an alien, he fell in love with her and took her form, so because he's repulsive to the Earth eye. Mm-hmm. And, of course, she, you know, freaks out and blacks out. And the last panel is her in a hospital, you know, recuperating. You know, I guess the car blows up and destroys all evidence of the carcass of this alien. You know, they just figure that, you know, she's been in this terrible car wreck, and they have some bad news for her. You know, her husband was burned beyond recognition, and he's, you know, he's a goner. But the good news is you're pregnant. Zap, you know. I mean,
right.
I must have read that when I was 10 or 11 years old, and it really stunned me, and it really stuck with me. And I, you know, I guess part of my fascination with comic books is that I never knew that they had that long a history. I always figured that, you know, like it's like every generation thinks they discovered sex. I found out reading all those 80-page giants that those were pretty much my favorites. I mean, I'd say they seem to be the most for your. For your money, and those are the days when they were 25 cents
sure.
for an 80-page giant. And I realize in retrospect that all of those stories were Golden Age stories for the most part. To find, especially the way comic books were during World War II and how they reflected the times and got us through the war and were, you know, probably had more adult readers than they had children readers because of all the servicemen getting these things.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, surveys, marketing surveys were taken back then, and there were more adult readers than children readers. And in fact, there were about the same number of men and women reading comics in the 40s.
I believe that. It's
of course, yeah, they had more different kinds of comics in those days.
They did. I mean, it seemed like they, you know, there was as much variety in comic books as there are in paperback novels. I mean,
you just quoted me.
And westerns and funny stories and funny animals and, or were superheroes always the biggest?
No, they weren't always the biggest. There was a short period of time in the early 40s where they were, and then not again until really the 60s.
Yeah, well, they nearly died out, didn't they, when the Comics Code came in?
Yeah, they just about did. Yep.
I mean, I have a storyline in development just in terms, I'm not saying in development with any major studio, but I seem to think that there's a wonderful movie to be made about those times. About, I mean, it's got to be a rock and roll movie, but
mm-hmm.
All of those hearings seem to fascinate me. I'd love to be able to do research on the Kefauver Committee. I mean, the first one I ever saw with my own eyes was Watergate on television. That fascinated me. Right up on through to, I mean, whenever they put televised hearings on television, in a way, I'm glad I don't get court TV. I'd probably be watching way too much television because, I mean, I followed the Clarence Thomas, and then I got hooked on the Simpson trial.
Well, Mark, there is tape available of a lot of that stuff.
Of the Kefauver Committee?
Yeah, because right after he took on comics, he took on baseball, and there's videotape of that.
What was his beef with baseball?
I am not sure what it was, but he felt it was corrupt, and so he decided to have all the baseball stars testify to Congress.
Wow,
and
even
of course,
rating.
Yeah, well, yeah, he never went after the owners of baseball. He just went after the baseball stars, you know, Mickey Mantle and folks like that.
You know, I didn't
that.
Know that.
And Casey Stengel did his Stengelese for 45 minutes, and after he was done, the guy was like, says, that's enough, and he left, and Mickey Mantle was next guy and said, I agree with everything Casey said.
Whatever that was.
Whatever it was, and it's
did,
a pretty...
Did Yogi Berra...
Yeah, I think Yogi Berra was on there. There was about half the people they brought before them were Yankees because, of course, they were the champs all the time. But, I mean, you know, he was just after more ratings, that's all.
Oh, I'm sure. It's like, what do I do now to top that?
Yeah.
And but, it probably, if the baseball thing had been a success, he would have gone on to, I don't know, movies.
Movies, right? Anyway, back to comics. Now, what comics did you read when you were a kid? Was it all the DC stuff, or did you read Marvels? And
well, I'm trying to think back because, to put it all in context, I'm the middle of seven kids. So I had an older brother and two older sisters and a younger brother and two younger sisters. And like I say, for the most part, I read whatever comics my friends had. Because for the most part, the only way we could legitimately buy them is if we were going on a long car trip. And we didn't go on that many long car trips. He sort of turned a blind eye to Classics Illustrated, because at least that was based on the classics. And I have to admit, a lot of the Classics Illustrated I read first and then wanted to read the legitimate version. I did that with 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It was almost like a Cliff Notes in the sense that you could get a fix on the characters and a general idea of what you were going to read, and then you'd read the novel,
right?
Just to see how it differed. I seem to remember loving Dennis the Menace comics when I was really, probably when I was like 5 and 6, when I was just starting to read. My brother had a lot of the Mad comics, but in paperback form.
Right.
Loved those. Absolutely loved those. Super Duper Man and Starchy and all that. And, the thing was, it's like whatever was in that form. I love the Sunday Funnies every Sunday. And anything that was in comic book form, I would read. I mean, I remember reading Catholic comic books just because they were in the form of comics. So if my sisters had an Archie and Veronica, I'd read that. My brother liked Uncle Scrooge, and I thought those were pretty good. Nothing regularly. I don't think I follow the title month by month, but then I hooked up with a guy, Mike Coity, who had like a box of DCs, and I did. I loved Superman and Batman, Justice League, and so forth. It was, I'm guessing, the summer of... Summer of 61 is probably when I was, really, really into comic books, to the point where you'd go over to somebody's house, you'd say hello, you'd sit down, you'd talk a little bit about what you'd read, what you thought were good titles and so forth, and then you'd start reading. And you might be immersed in that world only to, switch comic books, so you exchange a couple of words. Until his mother would stick his head in the door and say, "Your mom's calling. You're late for dinner. Go home." And it was 6 o'clock. That was like the summer of 61. I remember when I lived in Brooklyn. There was a guy down the street there was some sort of club he had. I remember paying my membership dues, and it was great because if you could get the dime membership, everybody kind of pooled their comic books. And it was an actual comic book club, so that would have been between third and fourth grade.
Wow.
And I kept on reading them right up until like 64. I still wanted them, but I just didn't have really the dough for them. And then I remember being sort of embarrassed that my sisters would say stuff like, I had a girlfriend, Laura Lee Spiro, I remember her name was, and my sister said, "Are you going to let her see your copy of Jimmy Olsen comics?" And I thought, oh, yeah, I guess that's not cool, huh? I mean, they would sort of shame you out of... I remember so many things I threw away because they'd say, "Well, that's so baby. You don't want to be a baby." Mm-hmm. My brother said the same thing happened to me. He's looking at this Howdy Doody puppet I picked up for, I don't know, $150 somewhere in the box, and he goes, "Wow, I remember this. I got it for $1.98 new."
Mm-hmm.
And it was like in 1952 or something like that. You don't even remember, because by the time you were old enough to toddle around and play with toys, it was long gone. And he said the same thing happened to him. He loved that puppet, but as he started getting into junior high school and high school, he kept it in the closet, and it was sort of a hidden guilty pleasure that he didn't really want to admit. And then eventually, a lot of it had to do with the fact that my father was in the Navy, so we'd move every couple of years, and we have to shed all the excess baggage.
Yeah, right.
But I'll never forget going to a convention when I was first discovering them. I mean, I'd love to go out to those comic book conventions because you'd see so many books, even if you didn't have a chance to buy them, that you'd never seen before.
So when
somebody was wearing a shirt there that just said, "My mom gave them away." That's all it said on his shirt. And that really, really hit home with me. I knew exactly what he meant. So, I mean, to answer your question in a roundabout way, I sort of like was in the beginning of Marvel, and I never stuck with it past, like, I gave him up from about 64 to when I was in college. And when I was in college, I was reading all the undergrounds. Gilbert Shelton, R. Crumb, all of those people were, you know, I mean, all those counterculture people I really like. But there was a limited output, and I remember I had a voracious appetite to read these things, and I discovered an old bookstore just off Hollywood Boulevard. It was Cherokee Books and Bond Street Books, and I went in there, and I saw several books that I had had a special fondness for, a memory of from my childhood, like a book, Dennis the Menace Goes to Hollywood, I remember, was one that was in the car. We used to take these car trips, you know, from coast to coast, 3,000 miles. It'd take like 7, 8, 9 days or whatever. And we were allowed, they'd give us a couple of bucks, and we'd go out and buy whatever we wanted, whether it was coloring books or whatever. And this one book really struck a chord with me. I saw it in the store, and so my original foray into collecting was to acquire the books that I had loved as a kid and had either lost or not kept in good condition. You know, you'd lend them out and people would leave them out in the rain or something.
WBAI's environmental show Ecologic is on every other Tuesday evening. Listen to scientists, activists, authors, and other experts discuss public policy and give you information on topics such as climate change, air, water, environmental justice, energy, both poisonous and renewable, healthy food, wildlife, transportation, green buildings, and of course, connections with other issues. You'll always find out what you can do to make the environment better, and every show starts with news and announcements on environmental actions. With your host, Ken Gale, every other Tuesday at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?
Hi, this is Jesse Eisenberg. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org.
Yes, you are listening to Enough Said version of Hour of the Wolf. Jim Fraun has the flu. He'll be back next week. I'm Ken Gale, and I did Enough Said here from 93 till 2007, and occasionally still do it on Hour of the Wolf. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. We're live streaming, so if you know anybody who you think should be listening to this show, well, they can, no matter where in the world they live, by going to WBAI.org. They can listen to anything that's being broadcast. And the movie that Mark Hamill and I were talking about there was Rudy, the one where their kids imitated the movie by lying in the middle of the road and getting run over. And that really happened when that movie came out. Bizarre. Of course, that interview is with Mark Hamill, who, besides being Luke Skywalker on Star Wars, is also a major comic book fan. We also talked about how anything that kids are into gets censored by some do-gooder adult group. And there is a book about that going through history, including dime novels and children's radio shows and video games. It's called Children, Culture, and Controversy. It's by Mark I. West, Children, Culture, and Controversy. And he points out that when a kid has their own money and buys something for themselves, it's not necessarily what their parent would have bought for them. And that's where the problem arises, when a kid's taste is different than their parents' taste. So Children, Culture, and Controversy, Mark I. West. It's long out of print, so you'll have to search for it a little bit. And I also want to mention a science fiction convention that, well, Jim was at it last year. I suppose he'll be at it this year, called Heliosphere. It's from March 9th to 11th in Tarrytown, New York, at the Doubletree Hotel there. And you can get more information by going to heliospheryny.org. It's heliospheryny.org. And I hope to see many of you there. And I also didn't want to leave this show without mentioning the passing of one of the greats in the comic book industry. Usually when one of the greats passes away, you hear about it for a long time. Len Wein's passing hasn't gotten a whole lot of notice, which really kind of bothers me. He created Wolverine, one of the most popular characters in comics. He created Swamp Thing. He was just simply a really, really, really good writer. Not a bad editor, but his writing. And I think because the writing towards the end of his career wasn't as good, I think people are forgetting how really, really good he had been. But I did want to mark the passing of Len Wein. And now I will just go right back to more of the interview with Mark Hamill. So stay tuned.
So you got into comics when you were young, got out of them, then got back into them because of underground comics, and then just discovered conventions and started collecting again.
Yeah, and also, too, I discovered the price guide. And to me, the price guide, I mean, when I first discovered it, I thought it was interesting that someone was just trying to amass all the titles. I thought that was really kind of an ambitious undertaking, and I loved all the reproductions of the covers. I mean, I just love comic book cover art. And to me, I would guess I'd say I'm an esoteric. If I specialize in anything, I love esoteric comics. I love, If the Devil Could Talk. And I mean, some of my favorites that I have would be like,
How about the Gorilla covers?
Well, yeah, I mean, all of that. I mean, I can't really hone it down to one thing I love. I mean, I treasure the moments I've been able to spend with people like Joe Orlando or Julie Schwartz. I mean, he talked at length one time. He came out to the house. Bill Mooney brought him out, and Miguel Ferrer, two actor friends of mine who we actually became friends through collecting. And Julie Schwartz was out there. I remember I brought out my cavalcade of comics that he had edited, and he went on about these gorilla comics. You know, I mean, the fact that they knew they put a gorilla on the cover, you know, boys our age, whatever that range was, from 8 to 14 or whatever, would just go nuts. We all love King Kong.
Yeah.
I mean, King Kong to boys is what I think Gone with the Wind is to girls. It's like this epic romance and it's a heartbreaker, that movie. Loved King Kong, loved stop frame animation, loved Famous Monsters of Filmland and the monster model kits, the Aurora kits. I do have a lot of times I say I don't understand, why people are so, it's funny that you don't understand it in other people, but you don't understand it in yourself. I mean, I guess my point is that I have a fondness for a certain part of, let's say, early 60s pop culture, and because I see it through the eyes of what I thought of it when I was that age. And it helped me when I see people, that are like belong to societies where they just worship, say, Wizard of Oz, the film, or even Star Wars fans, or people that are called, I don't know if they like to be called Trekkies, or anybody that's into some particular thing. You've seen it for Lord of the Rings or any kind of, any cult thing. When I have problems understanding it, I have to, look at myself and say, why the fascination with these. I especially love, Ken, seeing these comics I remember reading as a kid. Because I can remember my impressions of them. Well, I'm working on something now that it comes from my realization as a child that I remember thinking Superman was definitely a fantasy because he could fly and he could see through solid objects and all this. But to me, at that age, Batman, by contrast, seemed highly realistic to me. I mean, I really believe somebody that was wealthy like that could hone his mind and his body and become a vigilante crime fighter. And then you get to the age 18 to 21 or whatever, and you look back and say, Jesus, you know, in the real world, this is just ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the overly...
The suspension of disbelief.
What's that?
The suspension of disbelief while you're reading
it. Yes. But I love, too, the kind of childlike male-female relationships as they're portrayed. I mean, it's totally legitimate. I mean, and now I'm talking about ancient history because comic books are so sophisticated now. I mean, they're just like mini-movies. There's no subject they can't tackle. I mean, when you look at something like Watchmen or Killing Joke and the sophistication of it all, It really makes the stories of, you know, Lois trying to unmask Clark as Superman so wonderfully and delightfully anachronistic. You know, feminists just must go insane when you look at the big goal in Lois's life is to marry Superman. It's wonderful.
No. What exactly is the appeal comics have? I mean, is it a similar appeal that films have to you?
Probably, because you can pick it up immediately, and I mean, movies are sort of just out there. The interpretations, the music, everything is there for you. With comics, anyway, at least in your mind, you're doing the acting. You're figuring out how people speak, and I guess in the days before VCRs. It was a way to have something that you could rewind and review. I did love drawing, too. I loved to draw, and I loved to copy panels. And I'm sure if I were any good as an artist, I probably would have continued and found my own style. But, you know, I was good at copying panels. I mean, I was popular amongst my friends because they could say, draw me a this or draw me a that. And, you know, it would take me a long time, and I could... But I could reproduce panels, but you know, they're so immediately accessible, and there's so much variety out there. And also, it was a way to sort of, and I mean this about reading in general too. I mean, I'm not talking exclusively about comic books, but in a family of seven. You know, you really need your own space. And even if somebody was sitting next to you on the couch, if you were reading, you could be by yourself. You could be in that world. So I guess, I mean, the escapism worked on many levels. I mean, escape from the chaos of a family of seven.
That's a very interesting point of view about reading taking you somewhere.
Taking you somewhere else, yes.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to see people that are just... That have no other kind of reading material than comic books. I mean, I think that it would be great if there were a balance there. I mean, because I happen to believe that comics do promote reading. I really do. I think they're good things. I don't think they're bad things at all. And it was fun to have my own kids so that, you know, we have that tradition in this house. But it continues until they get tired of it, where you get a story every night.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's a Dr. Seuss or, you know, a Tales from the Bizarro World or whatever. I mean, I love those things that Russ Cochran put out a few years ago. Those John Stanley Little Lulus.
Oh, yeah.
Are so well done that, I mean, my boys, I mean, they're older now, but they still remember laughing out loud. I mean, just... full-on gutbusters reading those stories of Lulu and Annie and Iggy and Tubby going to summer camp and the rivalries. And I mean, those are incredible books. I mean, you talk about an early feminist, you know, without even trying. She was just awesome, Little Lulu.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because there's an organization of women comic fans who are trying to promote comics by and for women, and they're called the Friends of Lulu.
Oh, they couldn't have picked a better role model. I mean, that's how old is this organization?
About a year or two.
Oh, okay. So it's really fairly new.
Yeah, it's quite new.
I'm not as voraciously pursuing a comic book collection at this point. I mean, your priorities change. I had, it's a whole different thing. 10-15 years ago, getting to the point now where some of those Tony books from the Golden Age. I mean, you might as well be investing in original artwork. There's books I had where my accountant was saying, "Well, did you get that one into the vault yet?" And I figure if I'm having something in my possession that has to belong, it has to be put in a bank vault, something's wrong. Because some of the fun was, sharing them, looking at them. If you were a friend of mine and you came to my house, I'd want to haul them out and show them to you. That's why I love the reprints so much, both Marvel and DC, the Masterworks and whatever DC calls theirs.
Sure, and all the Golden Age reprints they did in the 70s.
Yes. I love the Golden Age reprints. When they were doing those 100-page super spectacular stuff,
yep.
That's when it was really attainable for the rank and file. Even these hardbacks are like 40, 50 bucks.
Yeah, I know.
I can't imagine being 11 years old and wanting that book of, like, say, All-Star. Where in the world would an 11-year-old get $49? It would just be unthinkable. I'm thinking a hardback book back in those days for us would have been $12.95, something like that. What would the prices be in 61, 63 of a book like that? It would still be unattainable.
Yeah.
I mean, it was all we could do to scrape together 12 cents. You go get the empty bottles and return them. That's one of the reasons. That's another way you can get comics. Just on Saturdays, I'd go around with a wagon, all canvassing the neighborhood, asking, "Can I take your spare bottles off your hands?" Because, I mean, most of the families wanted the money, but occasionally you'd find the bachelor or the newlyweds that didn't really care, and you could get together enough money to get down to the wherever you had to go, to the mom-and-pop store on your bike or whatever, and we go in coordinated groups, like four or five buddies. One guy would be heavy into science fiction. He'd be buying all those, titles that were sci-fi oriented. Like, I'm not even remember what they were, Tales of the Unexpected and
Mystery
all
in Space
stuff.
And yeah.
But we sort of, within the comic book world, we had a pretty well-rounded appetite because, everybody had their own specialty they'd concentrate on, but we passed them around. I mean, we weren't so knowledgeable about how the condition of the book is important, the way it is. Now, I remember buying Griffin, he's 12 now, but I must have bought him this when he was 10 or something. I bought him those Scratch and Sniff Ren and Stimpy number ones, and they were in polyethylene bags, right?
Yep.
So, like, we're cleaning out his closet 9 months later, and there they are, unopened. And I'm going, "Hey, what are you doing? Why didn't you read these?" And he's, "Dad, don't open those bags." We've got a whole generation now that thinks of comic books as investments.
Yep.
We've seen the profession, we've seen the hobby change before our eyes, and I don't know if it's all for the better. I mean, I was saying how I enjoyed looking at those price guides because it was fun to look at all the covers, and I love the ambitious undertaking. And I love just the dignity, the long overdue recognition of comic books as a legitimate art form. I mean, all of the new art forms in America went through that. Musical comedy wasn't taken seriously for years. And when it finally is, a lot of the greatest people are gone. People that aren't around to realize what they did is now revered by younger people. But the price guide, I think, like, really marks a beginning of the end of it as just a casual hobby. And I got in really at the tail end of that, because, I mean, I started collecting again probably the summer or fall of 1970, and didn't come on to the price guide until, like, maybe the second or third price guide. And by that time, I mean, still then, you could look at a book and say, "How much is this book?" And the guy would say, "Well, let me see, how much would you pay for it?" And you go, "Well, would 10 be all right?" You go, "Wow, I paid 12 for it myself. I want to at least make a margin a profit. You'd say, well, what about like 15? And he'll go, give me 17 and it's yours. And that's a different, that's a far cry from now when they look at that book as if it's the Bible.
Yep. Yeah, it is a Bible for a lot of folks.
I understand it, you know. I mean, it's always funny. You don't appreciate what you have until it's gone. And I sort of get nostalgic for the days when it seemed to be much more personal and a lot less. Anytime big money's involved, whether it's any whatever kind of collecting it is, if you're collecting stamps or belt buckles or whatever, when money and bigger money becomes involved, you know, it's some of the charm is gone. Because, you know, it attracts the kind of people that have no love for comic books, whatever, you know, any more than they have love for baseball cards or whatever they're hawking. It's just that the money attracts them, and it's very mercenary. That's why I know I could never be a comic book dealer, because, I mean, I have some pretty nice books, but I would never want to sell them. You know, I'm not somebody that goes out and buys two of everything and,
yeah,
you know, looking for the day when I can unload it and make a profit.
When we were talking on the phone a couple weeks ago, we were talking about comic books being transferred to film and how you were really into the old movie serials from the 40s.
Certainly fascinated by them, yes, yes. I, for a minute, thought you were going in the direction of these books being put on microfiche?
Oh, microfiche, yeah.
I ordered that out of, I haven't even read the Comic Buyer's Guide. I used to subscribe to it, and we're putting a second story on our house, and I guess I canceled my subscription or let my subscription run out a couple of years ago. But before I did, I ordered all that equipment, like that library equipment where you can, because I thought, you know, the truth of the matter is, I really enjoy reading the stories and looking at the art. Yeah, it's nice having some original books, but that's not totally where it's at for me.
Yeah.
But about the serials, I think probably my favorite serial from that era is the Captain Marvel. Did you ever see that?
Yeah, I saw it back when Phil Sewell was doing his conventions.
So you're back really at the dawn of these conventions.
Not really, because the convention started in 65, and I didn't start going to them until 73. So I missed them when they were just, you know, really tiny things.
Right. I would have guessed, if I had to guess when the very first con would have been, I would have guessed 68. You're saying 65,
65,
huh?
Yeah.
Huh.
And, but, you know, again, it was a handful of people, probably no bigger than your comic book club in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
And it just, you know, they did it every year, and so people would tell their friends. And
where, in New York?
In New York. And then eventually there was one in San Diego, and then one started in Ithaca, New York, and Chicago, and...
just grew from there.
It grew from there, yeah. Now there's, you know, every city has one or more a year.
Which is fantastic. Also, too, I mean, well, our lifetime we've seen the advent of actual comic book stores. I mean,
yeah.
That probably saved the industry.
In fact, it did. Yeah, it's everybody was talking about the death of the comic book industry all during the 70s, and the stores happened.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, it got dodgy there for a while because, you know, even being, I was in a place where, you know, you aside from being in New York, you couldn't be in a better place to buy comic books than Los Angeles. And even there, in the early 70s, as these stores that didn't have a lot of space, realize, you know, if they sold a Life magazine or a McCall's, they're going to make, you know, the same kind of profit as if they sell five or six comic books.
Yep.
There was just no place to sell them anymore. And mom-and-pop stores were, you know, I have the best memories in the world of this mom-and-pop fountain down the street when I lived in Brooklyn. And it had everything, you know. It had the soda fountain, squirt guns, caps, silly putty, you know, that rack of comics.
Yep. Yeah, you don't. There are places like that just that don't exist.
I know, it's really too bad. I miss the mom and pop stores. I mean, everything's so impersonal now. You know, on the one hand, you go, yeah, it's great. You get the lowest prices at Toys R Us, but it's not. I mean, you have a whole building of teenagers with that minimum wage glazed look in their eyes who know nothing about toys and don't care.
And comics aren't going to get impulse buyers or new readers because you have to go to a specialty store to get them.
Yeah.
You can't pick them up while you're getting your cigarettes or whatever.
Yeah, you're right. I know. I mean, I guess now they have the Archie people have the Digest and Disney, like in supermarkets, right at the checkout stand for the impulse buying, like you
right.
say, but not the wide range like we'd like to see. You know, I'm not really up on... The last time I was really reading current books that were coming out, I remember, was during the crisis. The crisis on Infinite Earth, when they were shrinking all the multiple universes,
yep.
you know.
That was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, how long was it ago?
About 10 years ago.
It really made me laugh, because I was thinking, you know, here they are trying to make comic books, like, more realistic. But I think I loved... I mean, I'm one of these people, I'm probably really out of the mainstream in this regard, but I mean, I think the Mort Weisinger and the silly era of DC is pretty funny. I mean, it's not that kind of tough, action-oriented stuff that most of the fans like, but, you know, I love the concept of the alternate Earths. You know, they had some leeway in terms of being able to do stories that don't fit into the regular continuity, but, you know, they build up all this baggage, and I guess Marvel was able to build a universe from scratch where it's all integrated, where, you know, the Thing lives in the same world as Iron Man, as X-Men, as everybody else, but it makes me laugh. I mean, what's the final result of crisis? Has it worked? Has it fixed everything?
Hardly. It's made things worse, because it's sort of like, you know, the jury will disregard that last story, and of course, well, you've read the story, you can't disregard it. And now they have to do Zero Hour, and they have to do all these fixing continuity stories almost every summer, and it just hasn't worked at all.
Well, are they still doing stories that they have to ask you to disregard, or are you
yep.
talking about stories that were printed before they tried to integrate it all into one universe?
They're still doing stories that say that all the other stories of this character don't count anymore.
Oh.
And both DC and Marvel do that. Marvel just introduced something saying that all the Spider-Man stories over the past 10 years were a Spider-Man clone. It wasn't really Spider-Man. And, you know, John Byrne did Superman and redid it. Somebody else came along and redid Superman again. There's a constant fixing. And I think it's also, when crisis happened, they can ignore all previous writers. So all the new writers, they ignore all the previous writers.
Right.
And this has been going on for a long time. I was thinking of you during crisis because... we met at West Side Comics
right.
not that long before that.
Right.
And you were just buying DC Comics. And,
yes, that's true.
And I realized that you and I have similar tastes, and I was wondering if you got as disgusted during crisis as I did, and it sounds like you did.
Well, you know, I thought, you know, what's the point of all this? I mean, it seems to me that some of the greatest things that you can accomplish in the medium... you can only accomplish it in that medium. They don't do these kind of things in me. I remember my wife was a big Dallas watcher, right? And so there was this big thing, how was it? Patrick Duffy left the show, and then they decided to come back. And so they had him coming out of the shower after he was dead, and then you realize that it was all a dream
right.
that his wife had had. And this outraged all of these viewers, and all I could... it made me chuckle to myself because I said, wait a minute, I've seen this a billion times. Every time Lois was married to Clark. You know, it was always that kind of a thing. I mean, in the continuity right now, for instance, does Lois know Clark is Superman?
Yeah, I don't know, because I kind of stopped following DC after Crisis myself.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the thing is, I
keep track, because I know writers and artists in the business, and they keep me up to date on things.
Maybe this whole season of the TV show is going to be a big dream sequence.
What's going on? Because, I mean, I for the first time a couple of weeks ago, The Simpsons was not on, so we watched Superman. It was a story where, let's see, what was it? I think, did she become Superwoman or something like that, which kind of reminded me of the Mort Weisinger era anyway. But I was surprised that she knew he was it's like they know now. I mean, they're trying to make it realistic. I mean, everyone's, you know, like you say, that leap of faith that pair of glasses disguises him enough so that she doesn't know it's him. But
in one episode, she puts on his glasses, and he says, "Where'd Lois go?"
Oh, I love it. That's very funny. You know, I mean, they're treading a fine line there, because I see what they're doing. They're making it more like one of those kind of romantic comedies, like Moonlighting or something. And I think that's smart in a way, because they're going after the demographic they're trying to compensate for is the demographic that mostly rejects comic related TV shows, and that's young women.
Right.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Why doesn't he come?
Were you waiting for me, Dan Malley?
Who's that? Who spoke?
The Shadow.
The Shadow.
There isn't much time, Mally. They're coming after you to take you to the chair. Speak quickly. What have you to say?
Just this. For the best in old-time radio thrills, adventure, and comedy, tune in to the Golden Age of Radio, 7 to 9, Sunday nights, right here on WBAI New York.
And you've been listening to an interview with Mark Hamill that I conducted on November 8th, 1995. So that's why there's references to Crisis and Infinite Earths only being 10 years ago and Dallas and things like that. The Friends of Lulu organization about comics by and for women has since dissolved and had a wonderful run and did a lot of wonderful things. That third voice you heard was Ed Menge, who was my partner in Nuff Said, the original place where this interview appeared back in 95. I just really enjoyed Mark Hamill's enthusiasm for comics. It was a lot of fun, and it led Ed and I to do a lot of other fantasy shows. And boy, when he talked about, you know, bringing in deposit bottles, and that's where he got the money to buy comics, I did the same thing. And of course, I did not know I was doing an environmental service, keeping garbage out of the landfill or off of the garbage barge. And I sure agree with him that the comic book price guide really, it turned comics from creativity to commodity. And it was the beginning of an end in a lot of ways. And, of course, the microfiche that he talked about has been replaced by the Internet. And there's an incredible number of comics on the Internet, and including stuff that I've written. People put on online, and he was praising Mort Weisinger's, you know, the comics that were kind of funny, maybe unintentionally so, maybe intentionally so, and I have found that, yeah, I like reading them, but not too many in a row, because then they just start coming across as just being insipid. And, of course, the major companies are still dissing every previous writer and artist that ever worked for them. And it's only gotten worse since that interview 22 years ago. And so one more section of the interview. And, again, you're listening to Hour of the Wolf. I am Ken Gale, sort of turning Hour of the Wolf into my show Nuff Said for a little while. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, where you can hear all the show in its entirety 5 or 10 minutes after it ends, as you can all the shows here at this station. So, back to Mark Hamill.
I mean, I remember doing The Flash and sort of getting into all that. I'd forgotten what network TV was like. I mean, I did a series back in 74, so, I mean, that was the last time I used to read all the reams of material that they'd do focus groups and all this stuff about, and you'd read all this feedback about your character or about the show in general and so forth. And on The Flash, you know, they started out trying to make it really kind of gritty and like a crime drama and de-emphasize the comic book elements. And I went in to go and pitch, I was hopefully going to pitch a storyline to them. I was going, my pitch was going to be, there should be a supervillain on the show. Because, I mean, I remember watching it with my sons, and we loved the first one. They were really little then. So after about 4 or 5 weeks, they stopped coming into my room, and I said, Nathan, Flash is on. How come you're not coming out? He goes, I don't know. I'm getting kind of sick of him fighting, like, motorcycle punks and gangsters. I mean, what are they going to do, run? And
right?
I said, you know, he does need... It's like Professor Sherlock Holmes needs Professor Moriarty.
Yeah.
I think these guys need, not every week, I mean, I didn't like Batman the TV series falling into that formula where every single week there had to be a supervillain, but I do know that when they decided to do the trickster and hired me to play the part and see, they were real nervous. They didn't ever want it to be campy like the TV Batman. They had this real phobia about the TV Batman as being not something they wanted to emulate at all. The movie Batman is what they wanted to emulate. And I kept thinking, you know, in a way, I don't know why people either love or hate that TV series, but in terms of it being accurate about a certain period of DC, they're pretty darn accurate. I mean, some of them, they're reading dialogue right out of the comic books. All that, meanwhile, in an abandoned factory at Stately Wayne Manor. I mean, those were the books that Dozier picked up. I mean, they were like 61, 62, 63 books, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the Jack Schiff stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's not Batman's best period in a lot of fans' opinions, and I mean, in some ways, I know it became formula, and they did it over and over, but what they did, I thought, was pretty different from anything else I'd seen on television at the time. So I remember thinking, well, it's not the kind of cool Batman I would have liked, but it's better than nothing. And I remember seeing the very first episode and thinking that, I mean, I still think that Frank Gorshin is probably my favorite villain in any comic book adaptation of anything. And I mean... Jack Nicholson and Jim Carrey are fantastic, but for some reason I've never seen or been impressed with an interpretation like Frank Gorshin's for the Riddler. And I mean, we certainly put in our homages to him in the two tricksters I did.
Yeah, you must have had a ball doing those tricksters, didn't you?
I did, though. I mean, I absolutely did, because it was like a dream come true in a way, because I loved playing that larger than life kind of stuff, but just playing it with conviction, totally with conviction, not ever winking at the camera or ever saying isn't what we're, I mean, like walking down the back lot at Warner Brothers in a skin tight spandex suit with a zipper up the back is the most logical thing for a criminal to do.
Uh-huh.
It's a wonderful, wacky world, isn't it?
Yeah, everybody was talking about it. Oh, you must have had a ball. You must have had a ball. And I was thinking, well, yeah, those are the comics that you read when you were a kid. So you're.
I really was. I mean, I just thought the scripts were well written, but Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo and I all sort of like, I mean, it's almost like talking with you guys. I mean, there's a certain chord that we share, that where we both know exactly what the other one's talking about. So there was a lot of shorthand in there, and they gave me a lot of leeway and were open to ideas of mine. I mean, they also shot some things down or said, no, we can't do that because of X, Y, or Z. But there's a lot of me in that part. And I'm sorry that the show didn't get renewed because the second season they were going to open it up with a two-hour TV movie that teamed Trickster with Captain Cold and Mirror Master.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah, I know, because I thought, well, gee, that's what I remember about The Flash. I mean, this guy, about every fourth issue, there would be multiple villains on the cover, at least in the era when I was reading it.
That's right.
You know, where Flash would be crumpled on the floor, and, you know, there'd be six villains standing around him.
And the villains were friends with each other.
Yeah.
It was an interesting little sort of society they had.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, you really have to, I mean, you're supposed to do your homework as an actor and figure out, okay, what motivates him? I mean, what is it about, you know, him that I mean, in the TV version of Trickster, I mean, he truly loathes the Flash. But I mean, those were the days when you could just say, well, it's because Superboy made Lex Luthor's hair accidentally fall out. He's really PO'd about that. And leave it at that. I mean, I ought to really pick up some modern-day titles that are considered. I would say, what's now, like, the hottest book going? Is it Animal Man or Sandman in terms of respect of the fan intelligentsia? What's the going book?
Oh, yeah, Sandman is probably still the, as far as the mainstream stuff goes.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's independent titles that have a great deal of respect, but for the mainstream, it's probably Sandman.
Right.
And, well, Marvels is pretty up there. Kurt Busiek's Marvels.
Which one? What was the word you used?
Marvels, by Kurt Busiek.
Oh.
A fully painted work and dealing with ordinary people responding to superheroes in their world. And it was a four-issue series that took you from the 40s right into the present day.
Oh, wait a minute. I think I picked up a couple of those. If the time frame is right, it was when I was doing the first Wing Commander, which would have been like, what year are we, 95? I did the sequel this summer. It was like 93 that happened? Or 94?
94.
Yes, and they were like real realistic renderings. It looked like oil paintings,
yes,
of what a guy would really look like in a Captain America costume.
Yep, that's it.
I bought those. I don't know that I've read them, but I was so struck by the look of them. I said, this looks great.
They were incredibly well written.
And they're spawning a whole lot of other series going off in that vein.
Yeah.
Trying to imitate that.
What's the gimmick there? That it's set in the real world, or it's just through the eyes of ordinary citizens?
It's through the eyes of ordinary people. There's this guy who is about to get married, and he's, you know, an old-fashioned man. This is in the 40s, and a man's supposed to take care of his family, and then all of a sudden there's this Samaritan and the Human Torch having a battle in his city, and they wreck the whole thing, and he says, my God, no man can keep his family safe with things like these around.
Right.
And he breaks off the engagement, and he's really freaked out about it. And then it takes you through his life. He becomes a photographer, and he photographs these creatures.
Right.
And
is that the character that runs through the whole series?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, what happened was I saw those books when I was doing the first Wing Commander, and I bought what I saw. I don't know how many, whether I got the whole series or what. And it was one of those things where I put them in a box and said, boy, I got to get to those when I can, and I still haven't gotten to them.
Well, they're wonderful comics, and if you didn't get them all, they're in a graphic novel format.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Will you get them all at once?
Yeah, you get them all at once.
I got to check it out, definitely.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, right now, I mean, I'm as you know, I'm coming out with a comic book of my own.
Yeah, from Dark Horse.
From Dark Horse. The Black Pearl will come out in the summer of 96, and it's interesting because, you know, there's kind of a problem in the sense that we looked at all of these comic book artists' work. You know, I would just go to a comic book store and spend hours flipping through what's out there and making lists of people who I thought impressed me or thought might be right to illustrate Black Pearl. The problem comes with the fact that a lot of the guys that are, the you know, at the top of their field are also writers themselves and who have no interest in illustrating something that they didn't write.
Right.
Totally understandable. I know I had lunch with John Byrne when he was in town, gave him a copy of the script, didn't hear back from him, which I'm assuming, I mean, this guy's plate must be really full.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect him to say, gee, I want to illustrate this. I was mostly, you know, I'll give the script out to people whose opinion I would value if they were going to, Peter David just read it for me. We're scheduled to have a phone call where he can give me tips on how to, what it is, fellas, is a screenplay that I wrote with Eric Johnson that was meant to be a modestly budgeted feature film, got into the hands of Dark Horse, and they bought it. And I thought as a marvelous opportunity to, it's almost like trying your play out of town and not having to open on Broadway. you can try things out in the comic book and that might help you hone the screenplay, bring it into sharper focus and so forth. It's funny, too, that it's ironic to me that it should become a comic book series because it has a lot to do with the tabloidization of society and the kind of harsher world that we live in right now, but it's definitely set in the real world. There's no fantasy in it whatsoever. If anything, it has to do with the effects of pop and junk culture, from rock and roll to movies to TV to everything, to all the sensory overload input that we have in our lives, sort of going on overload in one slightly unstable individual's mind, and he takes it upon himself to go out and attempt to do something, accomplish something that's very much influenced by comic books and movies and whatnot. But then to have to translate it back into comic book form is a supreme irony to me. But we're learning so much because with comics, I mean, for instance, the screenplay is like roughly 123 pages long. The five-part graphic novel will be 22 pages per for a page count of 110.
Mm-hmm.
So we're having to go in, and at first Dark Horse, they loved the script. They wanted us to do it, but they wanted us to hire somebody who has a background in comic books, who's written comic books all his life, pay him a fee, and have him adapt our screenplay to comics. And I said to Dark Horse, that's all well and good, and I am nervous. I have trepidation. There's fear of the unknown because I've never done this before. I don't know that I can do it. But I sure as hell want to try. If I just turn this over to, say, I mean, as a glorified ghostwriter, it wouldn't even be a ghostwriter because we would add his name to the list of credits.
Right.
We'd have to work it out where, you know, we make a two-partner deal into a three-partner deal. But my thrust here was that I wanted to be able to learn from the experience. Now, if I turn in a script that's totally unusable, and I think what happened was they really liked the idea of going into business with me. They thought I had a novel and good story idea, but they wanted an insurance policy. You know, they didn't want to come up to a deadline, get the script from me and say, this is totally unusable, you know, and you know, hurt my feelings or just say, you know, you can't do this. So they asked that I turn in a script with Eric Johnson in time so that if they didn't like what we came up with, because the thing is that obviously with a screenplay, there's much more backstories on all the characters. I mean, what you're seeing is a streamlined, not Cliff Notes version of the script, but I mean, we're finding a through line that's in the screenplay to follow much more closely in the comic book. I don't want to go on and on, and I hope I'm not boring you, but my point is that we've been able to find that thread, because the screenplay is more sprawling. Obviously, your camera's going to bounce around, and you're going to get to know the background of various characters in the storyline, and here we don't have the time for, especially there's one adult relationship. This couple has a past, and they've broken up, and his marriage was destroyed because he had an affair with her, and there's lots of exposition in the screenplay that explains who these people are, and we're finding that, you know, when we settled on the guy that's the focal point of the storyline and focus everything on him, a lot of the extraneous stuff falls to the wayside.
Uh-huh.
And my partner, by the way, is totally the opposite from me. He does not come from the comic book world at all, which is really why I sought him out. I needed somebody who's firmly grounded in the reality of so many adults our age who never read comic books, who, for them, that's not a frame of reference. I thought that was a real healthy balance. And, you know, he's looking at it as storyboarding the movie, and more than he's looking at it as comic books, the way I am.
Well, what's the difference between storyboarding the movie and doing a comic book version of it?
Well, you know, what you're doing is you're talking about two separate mediums. With a storyboard, you're trying to show the team involved, the actors, the cameramen, the special effects guys, whoever might be involved in getting that scene on the screen, exactly in chronological order how you are going to assemble images that are going to become that scene. So it's you're illustrating the film medium, which is different from the comic book medium. The best way I can describe it, I'm as much a neophyte as can be. I mean, I don't want to come off sounding like I'm an old hand at this, and I'm bringing 20 years of experience. What I got from the Dark Horse people and the artists and people that I've spoken to up there is they said, look at your story as a slideshow. So if you're going to have to show a guy, let's just pick a situation. You show a thug casing a liquor store, going into that liquor store, pretending like he's a customer, pulling out a gun, demanding money, and fleeing. With a minimum of 4 panels and as many as 6 or 7 panels per page, you're going to have to look at that as a slideshow. And, you don't want to be redundant with your panels. You might have an establishing shot of the liquor store with maybe the shoulder of the guy looking at the liquor store to show the guy standing outside the liquor store. I mean, you have to really break it down and let each single panel advance the storyline in a way that is pleasing to you and tells the story. I love it. It's like, it's really the basics. I mean, you look at these silent films of Alfred Hitchcock, and you understand how he was able to tell so much story with no dialogue. I mean, look at that shot in Vertigo where they're panning down the wall and you see a photographer involved in this, shooting a racing car and the car spinning out and the accident, and you pan down and there's Jimmy Stewart with his leg in a cast. I mean, just panning down that wall of photos, they give you the whole background of who that guy is. So even in his sound period, he was able to tell so much story in silent pictures, and that's the essence of good storytelling. I mean, even when we weren't thinking of this as a comic book, I said, I'd love to see 3 and 4 minute stretches of screen time where there is no dialogue if we're always giving the audience new information as we're doing that.
Right. Yeah, Frank. I saw on the stands just now, Frank Miller did an entire book of Sin City without any dialogue. There isn't even a title on the cover.
That's fantastic. You know, I mean, he's really something, that guy. I mean, you know, I hope he's gotten all of his due acknowledgement, you know, with the, you know, shaping the modern look of Batman for the movies. I mean, the influence of that Dark Knight is so apparent in the Tim Burton version.
Well, he certainly gets his due on this show.
What's the name of that book? Sin City.
Yeah, Sin City.
What's that thing that he did that's sort of like a big Japanese robot? I think Dark Horse did it. I haven't read it yet, but they sent it to me as to look at in terms of...
Oh, yeah. It's an oversized
It's an oversized,
comic, yeah.
Yeah, Big Boy or... Whatever it is, you know, I mean, again, the problem we're having is that most of the really good people can't spare the 9 months to a year they're going to have to devote to your project.
Do you have an artist?
Then, like, I found a couple of real hungry newcomers that didn't have any credits, and then, you know, the comic book company gets a little nervous because they don't have the experience. You know, this guy that I met through an actress on Wing Commander 4, Mark Bristol's his name, real talented guy out of Texas, young, too. He's got to be, like, 22, 25 in that area. I didn't really ask him, and I'm not good at guessing, but he's got to be two decades younger than me, and he drew some excellent renderings from the... I mean, he read the script, started drawing pictures of the Black Pearl and his lair and where he lives, and I said, boy, this guy's really close to what I'm thinking. And they, Dark Horse, when I sent him his sample, said, well, yeah, that looks really good, for instance, that picture right there. But can he draw that picture from every angle and make it look like the same guy? And I went to Mark. I said, Mark, can you do that? And you know what he said? I don't know. I don't know whether I could, because, I mean, he could draw him looking really good at this one, with the low camera angle and the moon in the background and all that. But, you know, like, he doesn't know whether he would be able to sustain a character look all through the book, that, you know, from every angle, that looks like the same guy. And, you know, you're looking at other stuff. I see guys that do great cityscapes and stuff, and I really need some urban squalor. And yet, you know, you say, gee, though, everything's so static. I don't know if that he can handle action. But I find myself falling prey to the same thing that bothered me as an actor, you know, that... These producers will see you in one thing, and they'll say, you know, I've heard things like, well, it's comedy, and Hamill doesn't do comedy. I mean, I went to Broadway and did all these comedies, and everybody said, oh, what a great surprise. But, you know, I mean, they look at something like playing Luke, and they say, oh, well, he is sort of a simple farm boy guy. So whenever we have those waspy, simple farm boy parts, we'll think of him. But we won't think of him as a sadistic killer or a transvestite or, you know, whatever.
Sure.
I have to guard against trying to stereotype artists or trying to imagine what they're capable of just from what I see on the page, and that's not always easy. But anyway, that's what we're doing tomorrow. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm not going to be able to stay with you guys the full time. We're tomorrow going out to... locations all around Southern California as much as we can do in about 8 hours, because I'll drop my kids off at school at about 7:30, and I'm going with my writing partner with a camera, and we're going out to, like, way out in Glendale and Pasadena and shooting, and Silver Lake, and shooting all kinds of reference photographs, because, I mean, some of the artists that are in the final running for this are, like, from Holland. That scares me.
Wow.
You know, there's one guy that's not as good, but he's in San Diego. I said, I could get in my car and drive to San Diego and really communicate with the guy, and he's American.
Sure.
Yeah. How does a guy from Holland, you know, I mean, this is so American, this thing. This is really like a B-movie, but like a Sam Fuller film, but you know, definitely idiosyncratically American. And it makes me nervous. I mean, you know, how's a guy from Holland supposed to draw a 57 Chevy? I don't know.
Well, maybe he can. Maybe he can.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. We'll find out. Because, I mean, once again, I'm being drawn in different directions. You can tell, like, this guy favors these guys, and I mean, it's really a lot more work than I ever imagined, because I really felt, well, the screenplay's finished. Peter David told me he adapted Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. I don't think it was ever published, but he said, you know, you can do what they say, which is where you divide the story into panels, you describe the panels, how many tiers, how many panels per tier, then, you know, panel one, the dialogue, the special effects. I mean, that's the old-fashioned hands-on approach, and that turns out, I mean, we just turned in our first issue last week, and that's the approach we used. I mean, it's as hands-on as you can get if you can't draw, because you're telling them what the angle is and who's saying what and what the special effects are. If there's a crack or a butta-da-butta-da-butta-da-butta-da, whatever it is, you write it down. That's the one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum that Peter David said, you know, he's used both, all of the different methods, but he said on Robin Hood, I would just circle huge passages of the screenplay, or I'd circle, you know, five lines of the screenplay and say, and put an arrow into the margin, panel one. And I'd draw a big black line through stuff I was cutting, and then I'd get to another thing, I'd circle that, say, panel two. And then, you know, they, like I say, I mean, until they read the first issue and were so relieved that we were able to do, you know, to adapt to this kind of form, the whole idea of bringing on a third guy that, you know, that can be our safety net was just, you know, that's gone now. But, I mean, like I say, I thought in the back of my mind, it's a finished piece, it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's not, I mean, we can go on with our other projects and not devote full time to this. And as it turns out, just to meet deadlines, we're doing 10-hour days every day. And I got to get up at 4 hours, comic. 4.5 hours.
Yeah, are you still doing the Joker? Are there still new ones coming out?
Unfortunately, there's not new ones coming out. I would love it for you guys. Make it your own little personal kind of mission. The only way I said, why aren't we going to do more Batman? They stopped at 85 episodes. And I have friends, you know, that said, you know, when the show became a big hit, that was the first voiceover series I did, you know, since I was, you know, the first year in the business when I did that Genie adaptation. But they said, oh, yeah, Ninja Turtles, we've done hundreds of those. So you're in for a long run, because at that time, Batman was number one. I think X-Men's gone past it now and something else, maybe Spider-Man. But, in, you know, when it first came out, it was the show.
It sure was.
And they stopped at 85. What I heard from the people at Warner Brothers, the people that I know at Warner Brothers, they said the only way they'd make more is if they got enough fan reaction saying, we want new ones.
Uh-huh.
Here's a bit of audio.
Or a thing of reruns.
Here's a bit of audio from Batman that we use on the show on occasion.
Oh, good.
Good evening, folks. I'm the Joker. Living proof that you don't have to be crazy to host this show, but it helps.
Wow. That's excellent. I'm very, you know, Paul Dini wrote that, I believe. I think that's Make Him Laugh. Is that, it might be, oh no, that's Christmas with the Joker, isn't it?
Huh?
That must be Christmas from the Joker.
That was, well, I don't know. I got it from, I forget which one it was. They're sitting around a card table telling their I Almost Got Him stories.
Oh, that's what it's called then. It's called Almost Got Him.
Almost Got Him.
Yeah. That's, you know, I got spoiled on that show because it being the first animated series, I just assumed they were all that well written.
Yeah, right.
And I'm really proud of that. I mean, obviously, I'm only a small cog in a big machine, but I thought they really came as close as you can come to a moving comic book in that series, because they're tight as a drum. They're really well written. The characterizations are just great. I mean, it's just a model of brevity, and I love the design. Oh, I love the way
brilliant.
It looks. I love Shirley Walker's music. It's a nice project to be involved in, but I would say, you know, if anybody's listening to the show right now and they like that show, drop a postcard in the mail, say, you know, I've seen every episode 5 times, 10 times. Please, please bring, you know, make some new ones, because they won't do it unless they think the public wants more. And I have a feeling that if the Warner Brothers network takes off, they might consider doing more. I mean, it was one of those things where they had a contract with Fox, and they were also trying to set up their own network. So, you have to order animation so far in advance. It's not like a live-action show where you can say, give us 6 more, and you'll have them in 3 months. You know what I mean? It's one of those long-term kind of investments.
Right.
So, but great. I'm glad you guys are sampling the show.
It's a ball to watch, listen to, and to sample, especially. I mean, that particular one just fits us so well.
yeah. Well, listen, I'll have to call back in when we're closer to getting this book out,
So that's The Black Pearl, and it's coming out this summer.
Yeah, this summer. And I don't know, maybe we'll be able to launch it at the San Diego Con. Do you guys ever go to there?
I haven't been
in years.
I go almost every year.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll stay in touch. And like I say, I mean, I hope people like it. I mean, it comes from someone who's one of them. I mean, one of the people that read it said, I don't know, aren't you sort of like slamming fans here? And I thought, well, I don't think so. I mean, if I am, I'm slamming myself.
I wish we could have more time with you, but we'll talk to you again this summer.
Yeah, I'd love that. I'd love that. And like I say, you know, we planned this so far in advance. I had no idea that I would not be able to wriggle out of this. I figured, hey, you know, if I stay up till 2:30 doing the show, all I have to do is, like, sleep in till 9:30 and I'll be okay. But, you know, life goes on. I've got 3 kids. I've got a writing partner. You know, I can't completely call my own shots, and I did promise I'd get this done tomorrow. So thank you guys for being so understanding.
Well, thank you for being on.
Okay.
Okay.
Good night, and thanks again.
Good night.
Okay, bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, so there we go.
And there we go.
So what shall we do next? Let's take a musical break and consider our options. Let's go to CD. Punch up a CD. Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
Hi, this is Joe Strummer, and you're listening to WBAI, and it's all mixed up, and it's mixed in, too.
Okay.
Oh, turn the music back on!
In a minute! First, noble human Homer Simpson will explain his primitive yet beautiful culture.
But perhaps Earth's greatest achievement is moon rocks. Oh, and the golden age of radio.
Ooh. Truly a species with much to offer.
Seriously? Are we listening to the same guy?
Yes, another unsolicited celebrity endorsement for the golden age of radio. Join me, Max Schmid, for the best of radio's history. Comedies, mysteries, you name it, we'll have it. Programs you may remember, if you're over 80, and programs that you've never heard of before. All fascinating stuff. Sunday nights, 7 to 9, right here on WBAI New York.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale of WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show, Ecologic. One of the cool things about being a BAI buddy is that you get to decide what WBAI is worth to you. Are we worth more than your cable TV? Or 10 bucks a month? 20, 100, a million? Just go to the WBAI.org website and sign up with your credit card. You'll barely notice it. In return, you get a WBAI tote bag to show off, free or discounted entry to special WBAI events, and other perks. Another cool thing about being a BAI buddy is less fundraising interruptions to your favorite programs. Go to WBAI.org. You can donate in the name of your favorite show, like Ecologic.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And you have been listening to an interview with Mark Hamill that I did on November 8th, 1995. So we were covered a lot of ground in an hour and 19 minutes. It was great to have that much time with him. That the second part in the summer of 96 never happened, and I really don't remember why not. And I did try to interview him again for BAI a few years ago when he was in New York, and that didn't quite work out either. And there were sort of new Batman animated episodes afterwards and sort of not. And they did find other people to do the voice for the Joker, although Mark has done it again since then. And in fact, I played at the beginning of the show two examples of Mark Hamill doing the Joker, reading a couple of tweets by the president. And I've got a couple more that I will play for you. They are wonderfully fun in a strange sort of way. We followed that interview back in 95 by taking listener phone calls for the rest of the show. I asked Mark when I talked to him on the phone before booking the interview if he wanted to take listener calls, and he said no. And he did not want to talk about Star Wars at the time because he said, you know, when the next movie comes out, I'll be in the audience like the rest of you. And the very first phone call we got that evening was saying, I tuned in late. Did he talk about Star Wars? And my thought, I said, not really. He mentioned Luke once and being stereotyped as an actor. But I was like, you know, this is why he didn't take calls. He can talk for an hour about comics and voice acting, and people will talk about Star Wars. back issues of his comic book, The Black Pearl, are surprisingly inexpensive. They are not that easy to find, but they're not that expensive. And, of course, when comics are not expensive, dealers tend to not bring them with them all the time. So comic shop will probably be your best bet to find them. And I sort of did a backhanded put down of editor Jack Schiff because of the Batman stories that came out in the early 60s before Julie Schwartz took over in 64. And I have learned from the years of doing Nuff Said, talking to writers and artists who worked for Jack Schiff, that he was a great editor. We did not give him credit because we did not know that the great Batman stories of the late 40s and early 50s that everybody loves and are considered classics, the stuff that Mark talked about from those 80-page giants, they were edited by Jack Schiff also. So what happened? Well, I found out from talking to so many people that Mort Weisinger's influence and he sort of got a little more clout because of his rather forceful personality and the fact that he was editing the Superman books during the Superman TV show, so they were selling well. And he's the one who got all those alien stories in the Batman comics. As much as Jack shipped up, but Jack was the editor, the buck stops with him. So he's not totally blameless, but he's not totally blamed either. We can't be putting down Jack Schiff because he edited stuff we didn't like and not compliment him for editing stuff what we did like. It's an important distinction to make. And another passing to note since I last sat in for Jim Freund here on Hour of the Wolf is the passing of Mort Walker. You know, if you know the name, the odds are you know because he wrote and drew Beetle Bailey since about 1950. But there was a lot more to the man than that because he helped steer the career to an awful lot of different writers and artists in the comic strip field. He was sort of the dad of the entire comic strip industry. For his longevity and his success and his personality. I always wondered, I never got a chance to really find out if the reason so many comic strip creators moved to Connecticut in the same general area is because that's where Mort Walker moved to. But that's the kind of respect that Mort has always garnered. And he wrote a wonderful book on comic strips and how they're done and a lot of, I think it's called Backstage at the Strips or something like that. But look for his book on comic strips. He talks about the history. He talks about the artistry. He gives you a lot of background detail. It's a wonderful book for anybody who likes to read comic strips from the newspaper. So Mort Walker passed away And let me play those those Mark Hamill Joker clips of our president, who I refer to as Agent Orange, before we run out of time. It's almost 3 o'clock. Lister is already here, ready to go. So here's Mark Hamill.
Meryl Streep, one of the most overrated actresses in Hollywood, doesn't know me, but attacked last night at the Golden Globes. She is a Hillary flunky who lost big. For the 100th time, I never mocked a disabled reporter, would never do that, but simply showed him groveling when he totally changed a 16-year-old story that he had written in order to make me look bad. Just more very dishonest media. Watching Senator Richard Blumenthal speak of Comey is a joke. Richie devised one of the greatest military frauds in U.S. history. For years, as a Pole in Connecticut, Blumenthal would talk of his bravery and conquests in Vietnam. Except, he was never there. When caught, he cried like a baby and begged for forgiveness. And now, he is judge and jury. He should be the one who's investigated for his acts. The Russia Trumpster collusion story is a total hoax. When will this taxpayer-funded charade end? Fake news!
You can find those on YouTube. Look up Mark Hamill, Trump's Joker, and you'll find he did 6 different ones. At least 6 different ones, and a lot of people have put them on YouTube, and a lot of people put music background and put in all kinds of other stuff, and one of them, I couldn't find any version that did not have some sort of musical background to it, and I just wanted to play just Mark Hamill doing that voice. I remember there was an interview with Mark Hamill on that somebody put on YouTube of somebody talking to him about his Joker voice and him saying that he was nervous when he first got the gig because, everybody has a voice of the Joker when they read the comics. And the host quickly said, well, yeah, but now everybody's voice in their head is yours, to which the audience applauded and cheered. And I certainly agree with that. Although Heath Ledger did do a good Joker, and Mark Hamill actually compliments him. There's a YouTube video on that as well. But anyway, I had a ball, as you could probably tell, talking with Mark Hamill for an hour and 19 minutes back in 95. And I want to, again, thank Jim Freund for giving me the opportunity to share this with you. It originally was broadcast at 4 in the morning. So that meant that Mark Hamill was on the phone at 1 in the morning his time, and very gracious to give us that time. And he was clearly having a lot of fun as well. And I still recommend Marvels by Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross. Wonderful graphic novel, and I think people are sort of forgetting that it came out. And it really kind of put Kurt Busiek on the map as a great writer. So anyway, you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. If you missed the beginning of the show, you can hear all of it at about 5 or 10 minutes after the show ends on WBAI.org. And you can hear anything on BAI. We live stream everything. So you can go to WBAI.org and listen to things. You can tell your friends from out of town that they can hear BAI. You can tell your friends who moved and they miss BAI, like Gene and Adrian Colin did, that they can still hear it. And going to WBAI.org. It's all there. And the show will be archived for a couple of weeks. So if you missed it, if you're you want to tell your friends about it, and it's, you know, you're talking to them this weekend, hey, they can still listen to the show by going to WBAI.org and going to February 1st, and there will be Hour of the Wolf, and there will be the Mark Hamill interview. So thanks again, and I'm going to go out with some music, and I want to go out with a couple of my favorite patriotic songs. I think there's not enough left-wing patriotism, and so I wanted to definitely bring that out. So here is Phil Oakes and then The Call, and then it'll be Lister. So stay tuned.
When will America become America? When will America become America? When will the home we love mean freedom for everyone? When will America become America? Stop. When the last child has dropped, how long must mother's tears rain down on streets of fear? When will the home we love mean justice for everyone? When will America become America? When will America become America? When will America become America? When will the home we love mean freedom?
Soldiers are young and brave, shame for the world to see. A mystery to you and me. Angels will keep their watch, heaven will count the call. When will America become America? When will America become America? When will America become America? When will the home we love mean freedom for everyone? When will America become America?
'1929, Union miners walk the line, living lives as bleak and black as the coal dust in their lungs. Up steps a miner's wife, boys, it's time to join the fight. Which side are you on? Was the song that was sung.
They had a song to make their spirits rise. They had a song to help them organize. They had a song. Keep their eyes upon the prize, it made them strong. They had a song.
1963, black folks marching to be free, beaten up and thrown into a Ku Klux Southern jail. Freedom singers gave them voice, said for us there is no choice. We shall overcome, we cannot fail.
They had a song to make their spirits rise. They had a song to help them organize. They had a song to keep their eyes upon the prize. It made them strong. They had a song.
1965, Father Hudson's gentle tide strangled in the poisoned grip of corporation greed. Seeger dreamed of days gone by.
We can't let this river die.
With a banjo and a sloop, he sowed the seed.
They had a song to make their spirits rise. They had a song to help them organize. They had a song to keep their eyes upon the prize. It made them strong. They had a song.
When I leave, you can remember my lips. But the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am a revolutionary.
The red, white, and blue is good on you.
Just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ash.
meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Let's be
And you're in tune to Radio Station 99.5 FM New York, WBAI, WBAI.org, Pacifica Radio at its very best. This is Burn Baby Burn, where we burn the impurest red, white, and blue to ashes before 5 o'clock. Today's show is dedicated to Jessica Foles Woody and her daughter Isabel in Washington, D.C. 10 minutes before I got on the air last week, Thursday, Jessica Foles Woody passed away in her sleep from cancer. Cornerstone of the reggae scene in Stony Brook, Long Island, Full Hand Band, Kwame Eshimu, Sterling Bailey, the whole gang, Melody Brown, Carl Rosman, Kathy Rosman, so Kibrit and the whole family, Karen. We're gonna play all of her favorite tunes on radio today. Yeah. Jessica was a big fan of Rolling Stone. And she loved this group called Government Mule. Here we go. Yeah. One of her favorite artists was Freddie McGregor. And she became close friends with Freddie McGregor. And her pal in California, percussionist Larry McDonald from Taj Mahal's band was one of her favorite groups. We're gonna play all of them today, yeah. Jessica, Isabel, this is for you.